Good evening and welcome. My name is Anne Mora. I am a curator in the film department and one of the co-curators of Dalí Painting and Film that is currently on view here at MoMA on the sixth floor and will be so until September 15th. And also there's been quite an extensive film program that's been happening concurrently with the gallery exhibition. And that will also go through the 15th. So I welcome you to visit the theaters also. Tonight's program, Dalí in New York, examines the impact of Salvador Dalí's diverse aesthetic activities amongst the New York artistic community. Our panel this evening is comprised of scholars, artists, and filmmakers, each with a special narrative to offer concerning Dalí's experiences in New York. Before I introduce our esteemed group, I would like to thank the many MoMA staffers who made this evening possible: Wendy Woon, Pablo Higuera, Laura Bayless, Stephanie Hez, Jody Hauptman, Samantha Friedman, Andy Haas, Pierre Vaz, Tal Marks, and Greg Singer. And if I've forgotten your name, thanks is equal. Our panelists tonight are drawn from a diverse community of scholars and artists who have devoted much of their research and time to uncovering the connections between New York and Salvador Dalí. Ingrid Schaffner, who's our first speaker this evening, is senior curator at the Institute of Contemporary Art, University of Pennsylvania, and the author of the 2002 Princeton Architectural Press publication, Salvador Dalí's Dream of Venus, the Surrealist Funhouse from the 1939 World's Fair. Jonas Mekas is our second speaker, and he is the renowned experimental filmmaker and the director of the Anthology Film Archives. Jonas will share with us this evening two short films he made with Dalí in the mid-1960s. Our third speaker is Callie Angel, adjunct curator at the Whitney Museum of Modern Art for the Andy Warhol Film Project. And Callie is also the author of the Abrams 2006 publication, Andy Warhol Screen Test, the films of Andy Warhol, Catalogue Raisonné, Volume 1. And our final speaker this evening is Jack Bond, filmmaker. And Jack provides a rare opportunity to view Dalí's mind, as he would say, in mid-explosion in his film Dalí in New York. For those of you who would like to see the omnibus film program, Dalí in New York, that I organized, there is an additional opportunity tomorrow at 1:30 here in Theater 3. The program includes Joseph Cornell's film Rose Hobart of 1936, home movie footage of the Dream of Venus Pavilion at the 1939 World's Fair, documentary footage of Dalí shot by Albert and David Maisels, two short films by Jonas Mekas, two screen tests shot by Andy Warhol featuring Dalí, as well as the complete film Dalí in New York by Jack Bond. In the autobiography, The Secret Life of Salvador Dalí, in the summer of 1934, the artist writes that he was eager to come to New York. Dalí's paintings were beginning to sell at the Julian Levy Gallery, and the critical observations were positive. In Paris, Dalí wrote, quote, "Here everyone judges things from an aesthetic point of view based on their own intellectual interests. America was different. America chooses with all the unfathomable and elementary force of her unique and distinct biology. She knows as no one else does what she lacks and what she does not have, and all that America did not have on the spiritual plane, I was going to bring to her." Dalí had also met Alfred Barr in the 1930s, the founding director of the Museum of Modern Art, who encouraged him to visit New York. Even Barr's wife prophesied to a very superstitious Dalí that he would have a dazzling future in America. And so Dalí and his wife Gala were eager to make the transatlantic crossing, but were chronically short of funds. The American heiress and publisher Caress Crosby provided the Dalís with tickets aboard the SS Champlain. They were in tourist class. She was in first class. And on November 14, 1934, they arrived in New York Harbor. Upon seeing the urban landscape, Dalí commented, quote, "I went out on the deck of the Champlain, and suddenly I beheld New York. It rose before me, verdigris, pink, and creamy white. It looked like an immense Gothic Roquefort cheese. I love Roquefort. And then I exclaimed, 'New York salutes me.' But immediately the pride of the Catalonian blood of Christopher Columbus that flows through my veins cried to me and made me say, 'Present.' And I turned to salute the cosmic grandeur and the virgin originality of the American flag." So Dalí's references to America to that point had been derived mainly from the Hollywood gangster films he saw. He was especially fond of James Cagney and Paul Muni. Dalí believed America to be a country overrun with gangsterism and violence. Hollywood had convinced him of this, and when he arrived in New York, the beauty of the architecture and the rhythm of the city devoid of the cinematic rough and tumble led him to a lifelong affinity for this city. So tonight's panel will explore Dalí's diverse experiences and encounters in New York from the 1930s through the 1960s. Following the individual presentations, there will be a panel discussion and question and answer if time allows. So I thank you for coming this evening and appreciate if you would turn off your cell phones or pagers, whatever may emit light and sound. And we'll begin this evening with Ingrid Schaffner.
Thank you, Anna. I just wanted to quickly say thank you and to your colleagues for inviting me to speak with this incredible exhibition. I learned so much. Saw maybe a little more than I would have liked to. Dalí peeing on a pen, persistent memory, indelibly. But let's jump into The Dream of Venus, which Dalí created for the 1939 World's Fair, and which shares many themes and images with the works in the galleries right now. So, oh, I have my little cue. Okay, first the fair itself. This is the World Fair made famous by its emblematic theme structures, the Trilon and Perisphere, and its motto, Building a World of Tomorrow from the Tools of Today. Here we see the theme center at night, with this giant statue of George Washington presiding over the Court of Peace. A bit paradoxical, very paradoxical, because given a 1939 world war, not peace, lay in the immediate future. The Czech pavilion represented a country already occupied by the Nazis when the fair opened. In any case, when you look at the fair's official architecture and you think about the sense of American optimism and streamlined modernity that it embodies, nothing could be more out of step than Dalí's Dream of Venus. This spectacular accretion, a Baroque pile, an above-ground coral reef, a Roquefort cheese, these things that look like arms are Dalí's vernacular and his vernacular crutches, staving off the crush of the void. In short, it's an architecture of anxiety. So let's tour it. Okay, so the facade with this blow-up pin-up of Botticelli's Venus. The facade was animated by real-life women, girls making ballyhoo at passers-by. I'm trying to reel people in to come and walk through these legs spread over the entranceway and step right up to that fish head and buy a ticket. And you, oh, there's Dalí and Gala. So you go inside and you experience this series of surrealist tableau. First, this underwater living room where living liquid ladies tickle the ivories of a rubber piano woman. So this is the wet chamber. Next comes the dry chamber, where Venus lies asleep on her ardent couch, dreaming her dreams of all mankind. The couch is 36 feet long, and you walk along it past these lobsters on coal braziers under a corridor of dry umbrellas. Up to the next stage, which is set like a sort of store window display of showcasing highlights of surrealism. So there's Dalí's persistence of memory and works that refer to Massan and Magritte, amongst others. So finally, the grand finale, the rainy taxi of Christopher Columbus. Indoor, outdoor, four-door plumbing. There's Christopher Columbus in effigy there in the back seat. So this is all for a 25-cent ticket. Perhaps not surprisingly, the Dream of Venus is not part of the fair proper, but located on the amusement zone, almost equal in acreage to the rest of the fair with its zones of communication, technology, and culture. The amusement zone is just fun. To cross over into it was to be greeted or assaulted by what Life magazine described as The smell of the crowd mingled with that of buttered popcorn. This is where you would find, besides the parachute drop, Billy Rose's Aquacade, where Johnny Weissmuller and Eleanor Holmes performed daily amid scores of Aquabelle and Aquabeau. There was Admiral Byrd's Penguin Island, Frank Buck's Jungle Land, 30,000 animals and 30 African natives, Morris Guest's Midget Town, midgets at work and play, the Whale Family, the Infant Incubator, Strange as It Seems, where you could see the man with the iron eyelids, the famous Chicken Inn and Bar Room, and the Wall of Death, which was a motordrome with a live lion in the motorcyclist's sidecar. So how did Dalí's Dream of Venus come to be part of this Coney Island carnival zone? This man, Julian Levy, New York art dealer, major promoter of surrealism in America. It was Levy who had the idea of bringing surrealism to the World's Fair in the form of what he pitched. I'm sorry, it's a dinky slide, but in this prospectus as the funny house of tomorrow. It was going to be an eye-shaped building, the mind's eye being a metaphor for the imagination, wherein visitors would walk past a nightmare corridor and see actual surrealist works of art displayed in specially conceived installations. Levy builds his surrealist house as hilarious entertainment, at the same time an authentic surrealist experiment. The inspiration for it was the International Surrealist Exhibition that took place in 1938 in Paris, and in which many of Levy's artists participated. So this is in the entrance, where Salvador Dali's Rainy Taxi was on display. And this is the Hall of Mannequins, dressed or undressed by leading surrealist artists. And then the exhibition hall itself was designed by Marcel Duchamp with 1,000 sacks of coal hanging from the ceiling of a dark room, and visitors were issued flashlights in order to view the art. So you can see how this 1938 exhibition inspired Levy's surrealist funny house, which would have included Dalí as one of many artists that Levy hoped would participate. Levy's proposal for a surrealist fun house was approved by the fair officials. The next hurdle was finding funders. Levy turns to William Morris, the son of the head of the theatrical agency, who he likes the idea, but only if Levy can get some kind of star power to front this attraction. There is one artist in Levy's cast who stands out for the role. His face had appeared on the cover of Time magazine in 1936 when the Museum of Modern Art presented a blockbuster exhibition of surrealist art. And his name had more recently been in the news for pushing a mannequin out of a Bonwit Teller store window, which is another Dalí in New York story. Morris urges Levy to enlist this ready-made public sensation, and Levy acquiesces. So Dalí already had a show scheduled at the gallery, and when the show opens, it's accompanied by this brochure announcement that indicates that the Spanish surrealist is going to have something big to do with the upcoming World's Fair. We see the fair's icons, the Trilon and Perisphere, being energetically sodomized by the Helicline, which was the ramp designed to connect them. What exactly Dalí would do was still anyone's guess, even by April 10th, when he signs a contract specifying that he will design the facade, the interior, costumes, scenery, and souvenirs for an exhibition tentatively called Bottoms of the Sea. He's given a week to turn out his final sketches. Meanwhile, the Dalí World's Fair Corporation is formed. Its members include, besides Dalí and Morris, Dalí's great patron, Edward James, and a Pittsburgh industrialist named William Gardner, whom Dalí will come to nickname the Rubber Man for all of the casting and mold making that his company provides. So the fair opens on April 30th, 1939, and most of the amusement zone isn't ready. The Dream of Venus doesn't open until June 15th. The event slinks by a rather sordid affair. The dye that was used on the Living Liquid Lady's gloves is running and dirting up the water. The members of the Dalí World's Fair Corporation are barely speaking to one another, and Dalí isn't even there. He's left in a huff the night before on board ship bound for France, not before publicly disowning the Dream of Venus, which he deems did not turn out as planned. He distributes a tract allegedly from an airplane over Manhattan, entitled The Declaration of the Independence of the Imagination and the Rights of Man to His Own Madness. The tract ends with Dali proclaiming his love for the people of New York, who surely understand and sympathize with his compromised genius. I quote, in the nightmare of the American Venus, out of the darkness bristling with dry umbrellas, the celebrated taxi of Christopher Columbus. Christopher Columbus discovered America, and another Catalan, Salvador Dali, has just rediscovered Christopher Columbus. New York, you who are the half-cut flower of heaven, you who are as mad as the moon, I go and I arrive. I love you with all my heart. Dali. Despite Dali's shame, the public seems genuinely intrigued. Vogue magazine coos, hundreds of thousands will see it and wonder at the strangely shaped cabana whitewashed in pale pink. Thousands will walk through it, puzzled and perhaps amused. Thousands will roar with laughter, but the more erudite will recognize Dali's symbolic conception of the maternal complex, the dark, safe dream of an atavistic, watery world. Yeah, well, maybe. Of course, the main attraction is the swimming women. Countless articles on them as performers, as working girls, as, oh, I love this, the Dali garbage can. As sex objects. In a New Yorker piece called Surrealist Babes, we learn about Kelsey Carr. She's a mighty cute little Southern girl who holds the record for swimming underwater for 45 seconds and has the further distinction of being able to go into the tank right after eating without suffering indigestion. Remember, this was the age of burlesque. Nevertheless, it does raise the issue of nudity at the fair, about which Time magazine specifically calls out the Dream of Venus for commendation. At its worst, the fair's nudity is so much peeping Tommy rot. Unalluring are the Arctic girls, frozen inside cakes of ice. I bet they were. Far cleverer, far more alluring, is the show that opened last week by surrealist Salvador Dali. A writhing plaster castle on the outside, it shrewdly combines surrealism with sex. Inside proves that there's plenty of Broadway method in Dali's madness. The New York World's Fair operated for two seasons, and in the 1940 season, Dali's Dream of Venus reopened under the management of William Gardner, the rubber man. The rest of the corporation had dissolved. Gardner rechristens the funhouse 20,000 Legs Under the Sea and introduces his own creation to the underwater tableau. Oscar, the amorous octopus, a man in a no-doubt rubber octopus suit who grabs at the women as they swim by. The fair finally closes in 1940. The New Yorker describes the last days as a melee of visitors gone mad, drinking hot zombies, and stealing anything that would move. The Dream of Venus, like the rest of the fair's buildings, was razed. Allegedly, some of the painted backdrops still exist, maybe some props. But what most significantly endures are these photographs by Eric Schall. My book was based on their discovery in Schall's estate. He was a photojournalist sent on assignment by Life magazine. And he photographs the dream inside and out during its construction and its performance. And it's his pictures that allow us to enter the dream state of Dali's Surrealist Funhouse at the 1939 World's Fair today. Thank you.
My first meeting with Salvador Dali was in 1956. Hans Richter was premiering his film 8x8 at the Museum of Modern Art. As a benefit for Film Culture magazine that I was editing, Salvador Dali supposed to make the main speech, telling everybody to give us a lot of money. But instead he sent a scroll, a long scroll, written in the usual Salvador Dali international language gibberish, which was read and for the great entertainment of everybody present. Next, I saw him several times in between, somewhere between 61, where he presented, and actually what you will see in one of the films, together with Professor Oster, he called a press conference to present his sensational new discovery called Moire, and the effect of it, as you will see. Then for the next 2 or 3 years, we did a lot of, he decided that he should become a happening artist, and he did. He bonded with Peter Beard, who provided him with some of the top models, working mostly with Vogue magazine, to participate in a series of happenings, which I filmed, and you will see that too. Our last meeting was when I was arrested for screening Jack Smith's film, Flaming Creatures, and I wanted to get some known, famous people of New York to support me, and he sent an official letter in which he said, "Not everything should be for everybody. I cannot defend you for what you did." Okay. And the rest, I guess there will be question and will be in the panel, but we should see the films.
One day, Salvador Dali was walking along the Fifth Avenue, and he noticed an old shoe lying. One day, Salvador Dali was walking along the Sixth Avenue, and it was raining. One day, Salvador Dali was walking into the elevator, and he bumped his head. Taylor and myself. It was a force working against us. It was a force. I felt my body, my throat, my body. Then my body was free. The woman was almost free. She is free. She is free. I shout. The people, they were looking. They were looking. Then, it's then that I saw my friend. The road. My friend. Well, they were all around him. My friend. I shouted, my friend. He arrived suddenly. I saw him standing there. Suddenly, everything became unreal, prepared, staged, ordered. There, I saw him posing, fighting his artificial pose. There he was, and the poems of the post-surrealist art began covering everything. Thank you.
probably a very elementary one, which is well known. These are lines. And if I have them at right angles, nothing happens. But watch as I make a smaller and smaller angle. Now you begin to see lines, big lines. And then they go to a small movement. Now they go to infinity. And they turn around and come back. See? Now, let me show you something.
Let me go stop something there.
Now, this
is quantum blood, like a Marx flower.
This is, for example, liquid flowing from a point. And now if we have a source and a sink, that liquid flows from the source to the sink. So when I hold them far apart, two opposing sources. You see? Stagnation point. Right, exactly. And you see? They oppose each other. It's the stagnation point. You see? Liquid opposing each other. There are structures in your eye which interact with this to make a moiré pattern. It's a moiré pattern that makes it disturbing. You see? You see?
Voila, 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 voila. With my Arabic origin, this is entrela, como happens is entrela, the Arab.
Interlocking
Arabic things, already can you look moving constantly, because the star becoming one dodecahedron or dodecahedron, and you can completely change constantly.
There's another culture that also feels it, and that's Japanese, because they have so much woven things, baskets.
And many people try, and Picasso try one time the mescaline, and the mescaline produce some hallucinations very close of this.
This remarkable drug, LSD.
LSD,
28.
And I swear he saw more. Yes, but you talk with one gun taking SD 22, and the description is exactly this kind of scene, exactly.
But I think it's quite objective. In other words, my general thesis is that the inhibition in your eye, you have inhibitions. Mm-hmm. That is, you cannot use the structure in your eye because it's impractical.
Accidentally, this becomes...
parallel from this on, we can say that we have to re-educate our eye in order to be able to see better than we have seen until now.
I think, though, an acute artist, maybe an ancient Greek, or maybe an Arab, I don't know, had this training. You know, it's a training which you can release when you look for it.
The Arabic people, because this exists probably in Greece, but after burn the Bibliothèque of Alexandria, everybody believes plenty of patterns, and this is everything disappears. Only Arabs catch little pieces of this. And these little pieces already wielding tremendous quantity of these combinations, because everyone is create one visual paradise, visual heaven of movements and changing things. But the only manner of approach is with Lomoide patterns. This is not true. This is possible to develop in artistic way in one.
Let me show you your English.
This is
a complex, extraordinaire, doesn't it?
I want to thank Anne Mora for inviting me here and Stephanie Hesch for the organizing she's done, and thank you all for coming. Andy Warhol and Salvador Dali met each other in the mid-1960s when Dali was nearing the end of his career, and Warhol's career as an artist and a filmmaker was just beginning to take off. I'm not sure how much Dali knew about Warhol at that time, but Warhol had been well aware of Dali and his work for several decades. There's an interesting story about Dali's influence on Warhol, which is related in Victor Bakris' biography of Warhol. In the spring of 1958, when Warhol was studying art at Carnegie Tech in Pittsburgh, he got a job, his first job as a commercial artist at Joseph Horn, a department store in downtown Pittsburgh. Warhol's job was to paint backdrops for the store's display windows. His boss was a man named Larry Vollmer. In an interview with Victor Bakris, Vollmer recollected that while he and Warhol were working, he told him about his experiences working with Dali in the late 1930s, installing two display windows that Dali had designed for Bonwit Tellers in New York City. One of these windows contained a bathtub lined in black Persian lamb and filled with water, from which rose three wax arms holding mirrors. In front of the tub stood a wax turn-of-the-century mannequin that Dali had found in the attics of the store. It was still dusty and swagged in cobwebs. He clothed the dummy in green feathers with long, bright red hair. The day after the installation, when Dali returned to the store to look at his windows, he was enraged to discover that the dusty mannequin had been replaced by a modern version clad in a snappy new suit. When the department store refused to restore Dali's creation to its original state, Dali climbed into the window and, in front of a large crowd of onlookers, proceeded to overturn the water-filled, fur-lined bathtub and send it crashing through the plate glass window onto the sidewalk. He was immediately arrested, spent the night in jail, and received a suspended sentence. The judge agreed that an artist had a right to defend his own work and noted that these are some of the privileges that an artist with temperament seems to enjoy. The resulting press coverage made Dali into a well-known figure in the United States and turned his exhibition at the Julian Levy Gallery into an enormous success with sales of over $15,000 in paintings and drawings. As Bakris points out, here was a lesson in public relations that Andy would not soon forget. It was also not lost on him that an artist as superior as Dali would stoop to doing commercial installations in a department store window. Years later, after Warhol had moved to New York, established himself as a highly successful commercial artist, and started painting some of his earliest pop artworks, he himself was hired by Bonwit Teller to design their display windows. Warhol selected a few of his new pop art canvases, arranged them behind the mannequins, and as far as I know, behaved impeccably. This is one of the important historical distinctions between Dali, their different attitudes toward their own work. For Dali, the introduction of an actual commercial product into his artwork was an outrage, calling for violent retribution. For Warhol, whose paintings sometimes seemed to be literally the same thing as product placement, these differences between high and low were exactly what his art was intended to eliminate. Warhol didn't actually meet Dali, I think, until the mid-1960s, at a time when Dali and his wife, Gala, were spending several months a year living at the St. Regis Hotel in New York. I don't know exactly when they met, but their meeting seems to have been facilitated by the actress Ultraviolet, who had been one of Dali's muses, a model and companion, since 1960, and who subsequently became one of Warhol's superstars. Ultraviolet's first Warhol film was The Life of Juanita Castro, which was shot at the factory in March 1965. But Warhol didn't film Dali until February 1966, when he shot two screen test portraits of the artists. By the way, I decided not to show the two Dali screen tests during this talk because they're both included in the exhibition, have been shown frequently in the theaters, and are also on view continuously in MoMA's lobby. So if you want to see them, you can just go next door. One of these screen test films was shot with the image right side up, and the other is upside down, meaning that Warhol turned the camera upside down during the filming. The right side up screen test, labeled Reel 2 on the leader, was found at the head of a compilation reel titled Original Salvador Dali, in which the Dali screen test is followed by screen tests of Nico, Sterling Morrison, and Lou Reed, and footage of Gerard Malanga and Mary Warnoff performing a sadomasochistic whip dance. This reel, Original Salvador Dali, was created for the Exploding Plastic Inevitable, or EPI, the multimedia performance events which were organized by Warhol and his colleagues to accompany live performances of the Velvet Underground, the proto-punk rock and roll band that Warhol managed in 1966. The EPI included live dancers, a filmmaking crew, strobe lights, colored and patterned slide projections, and films projected on as many as 5 projectors at once, some of them handheld. It seems possible that the second upside-down screen test of Dali, labeled Reel 1 on the leader, was shot for a similar compilation reel. One can imagine these two reels projected simultaneously during the EPI, with the two images of Dali, one right side up, the other upside down, looming above us side by side in the midst of this overwhelming sensory environment. Warhol's acquaintance with and filming of Salvador Dali echoes his relationship with another famous artist, Marcel Duchamp, whom Warhol deeply admired, even emulated, and filmed on several occasions. The first time was in October 1963, when Warhol made a short home movie of the opening of Duchamp's retrospective at the Long Beach Museum of Art in California. Warhol wanted to make a film called 24 Hours in Marcel Duchamp's Life, and apparently even found financial backing for this project, but the film was never realized, and in the end, Warhol was able to complete only 3 screen tests of Dali. These were shot, only 3 screen tests of Duchamp, which were shot, interestingly, around the same time as the Dali screen tests in February 66. There is some evidence that just as he had planned for Duchamp, Warhol also hoped to make a longer film of Dali or with Dali. This very slight evidence found among Warhol's papers, now at the Andy Warhol Museum in Pittsburgh, is a telegram to Warhol from Philip V.S. Smith of Smithtown, Long Island, commonly known as Fufu, the wealthy and litigious son of a famous railroad family who allegedly invested in some of Warhol's film projects. The telegram, which is dated June 2, 1966, reads as follows. Making arrangements for up to $100,000 to be available for our Dali Warhol flick. Call me today without fail, or the aforementioned can be written off and you will find yourself on the receiving end of a $60,000 lawsuit. I have found no other information relating to this Dali Warhol film. I imagine Warhol might have lost interest as soon as he read this telegram. Warhol continued his acquaintance with Dali intermittently throughout the 1970s during what might be called Warhol's society years, when they would meet at elegant dinners or at fancy restaurants like Lutèce. In 1979, Warhol published a book called Exposures, which is sort of an extended gossip column with photographs. Exposures was Warhol's portrait of the decade of the 70s, just as Popism was his memoir of the 60s, and Warhol included an entire chapter about Dali. As you know, Warhol was a brilliant social observer and could be very funny in print. Dali's one of my favorite artists because he's so big. He worships Andrew Wyeth, and so do I. Dali and Gala come to New York every year for a few months. They also spend a few months in Paris and a few months in Spain. In New York, they always stay at the St. Regis Hotel on Fifth Avenue. Every Sunday afternoon, they have people in for tea, champagne tea. Then Dali takes everyone to dinner at Trader Vic's. He's very generous. There are never less than 20 people, all the starving young beauties and transvestites in town. I'm not sure whether Dali copied transvestites from me or I copied transvestites from Dali. I love his entourage, especially Potassa de Lafayette, the transvestite, high fashion model from Santo Domingo. Someone told me that Potassa is the brand name of the best-selling hair pomade in Puerto Rico. Dolly surrounds himself with people who change their real names to brand names, just like my superstars of the 60s. Actually, I met Dolly in the 60s when one of my superstars, Ultraviolet, brought him to the factory. In those days, he went around with two ocelots on leashes. Warhol is poking fun at Dolly in this portrait, but this seems to be the kind of relationship they had, and Dolly poked fun at him as well. Warhol reported in his diary on March 9, 1978, that he had run into Dolly at a party, and Dolly told him that his idea for piss paintings was old-fashioned, since it had already been in the 1968 Pasolini movie Teorema. Warhol made so-called piss paintings by having people urinate on prepared canvases. So Dolly told him that this had already been in the Pasolini movie. "He's right," Warhol said. "I knew that." Dolly also gave Warhol a gift of a package of used palettes, a gesture that made Warhol laugh. Dolly's gift refers, of course, to the contrast between their painting styles, the microscopic realism and painstakingly old-fashioned technique of Dolly's handmade paintings versus Warhol's large-scale multiple canvases produced from Polaroid photographs, silkscreens, and paint applied with a squeegee and a mop. It's nice to think of these two groundbreaking geniuses, one old, the other younger, sharing a private joke about their respective roles in art history. In thinking about Dolly and Warhol, I'm struck by how very different their work was, and yet how many similarities there are between their careers. Both men were excessively timid when young. Both were given classical education in the arts. Both were founding members of important art movements of their time, surrealism and pop art. Both men made avant-garde films which became the most notorious works of their time, films which are now classics. Both Dolly and Warhol were fascinated by and attracted to Hollywood. Each artist found it necessary to develop a public persona for himself, a kind of exaggerated celebrity identity with which to engage and negotiate the public eye. Both Dolly and Warhol were enormously ambitious and sought to expand their art practice into fields previously excluded from the realm of fine arts, such as filmmaking, jewelry making, writing, fashion, furniture design, television performance, perfume, and so on. Dolly was the most explicit, the most unabashed in speaking about his ambition. "The thing that really counts is the almost imperialist structure of my genius. Painting is only an infinitesimal part of my genius. I express myself, as you know, with jewelry, flower beds, eroticism, mysticism. Painting is only one of the means of expression of my total genius, which exists when I write, when I live, when in some way or another I manifest my magic." Warhol was also a genius, although he would never have said so. And I think Warhol was even more of an imperialist in his artistic ambitions than Dolly was. In fact, his programmatic exploration and expansion into nearly every available field of cultural production, painting, sculpture, photography, film, television, theater, writing, magazine and book publishing, fashion, poetry, advertising, modeling, audio recordings, popular music, and so on, is unprecedented in the history of contemporary and modern art. Another difference between them was that Dolly saw himself as the subject at the center of his own art, his own artworks, his genius, his personality, his unconscious, his perceptions, his fears, his dreams, his imagination. Warhol, on the other hand, tried to erase his self from this equation, and in my opinion, largely succeeded. This difference is reflected in the very different ways in which the two approached film. Dolly was interested in film and the movies as a rich potential medium or vehicle for the expression of his own imagination. Further, Dali saw cinema as the perfect metaphor for his own creative genius. As he wrote quite beautifully in 1937, there are no pictures, there is only one, which you continue all your life on different canvases, like frames on the real film of the imagination. And Dali used film in this manner as a medium in which images from his imagination could be made real and presented in sequence. But Dali's ideas for film, however brilliant, were always subservient to the conventions of the medium. He understood and relied upon montage. He liked Hollywood comedy. He admired the special effects that were possible in film. He wrote scripts and tried to develop various projects, and he yearned after the technologies, production facilities, and finances that would put such techniques within his reach. Warhol more ambitiously, and I think with greater impact on film history, simply decided to do it all himself. He discovered that by redefining the technical and economic requirements of film production, he was able to invent, more or less from scratch, his own kind of cinema, to create his own avant-garde film studio, develop his own stable of movie stars, and produce what were then the longest movies ever made. Without scripts, without editing, without special effects, without real actors, often without sound, he made westerns, operas, porn films, soap operas, epics, star vehicles, sexploitation films, cultural documentaries, comedies, television shows, and television commercials, as well as a number of the most important art films of the 20th century. The differences between Warhol and Dali in both their art and filmmaking, of course, reflect their different positions in the continuum of art history. I like thinking about Warhol and Dali hanging out together in the 1960s and 70s. It's like imagining a fold in history, a moment when two very different eras met and touched each other. It makes you realize how fast art history can move sometimes.
Thanks very much for having me here. I'd like to attempt to recount my initial meeting with Dali, what we went through and how it all ended, really. I go back to the summer of 1965, when Dali's military advisor, as he called himself, Captain Peter Moore, called me summoning to a meeting with Dali himself at the Hotel Maurice in Paris. Captain Moore assured me that my chances, much as I wanted to, of working with Dali were actually practically zero. We entered a lavish suite, and there sat Dali himself in a high-backed throne-like chair. Moore was impeccably dressed, but Dali even more so, the shining hair slicked back, the waxed moustaches reaching skywards like quivering antennae. Now, if I'd been apprehensive about this encounter, and I had been, the tension in me seemed to just evaporate, for Dali's eyes sparkled with warmth. He wondered what kind of film I had in mind to make with him. And I don't know what had got into me, but I threw all caution to the wind. I told Dali I'd go to any lengths to film his mind in mid-explosion, a cascading, slow-motion exposition of all of his accumulated memories. He thought about this for a moment, and then, indeed, nothing more was said for several minutes. Then he smiled and he turned towards me and said, "I'd already decided to work with you when you were still coming up here in the elevator." At this moment, I recognized you as being probably talented and clever. I also fortunately recognize that you're not particularly intelligent. So that was the first and only gig I ever got for being stupid. Then we argued, and finally he proposed the unthinkable. A compromise. He agreed I could, after all, bring a flying radical camera approach to the project, so long as he could have in the visual field, as he called it, five white swans, all of which must explode in slow motion, providing a veritable feast for the eye of swans' entrails, pomegranate seeds, and billowing clouds of feathers. Dali held aloft his silver-handled ebony walking stick, drew a circle in the air with it, and then pointed the stick straight at me. following the swans, he said, must come 2,000 priests on bicycles. Well, I love the idea of the swans, I said. I didn't really, but there you go. But I didn't want anything to do with 2,000 priests. In fact, I didn't want anything to do with priests at all. Reluctantly, he agreed we would drop the priests. If instead I could supply a 7-foot-tall plaster cast of a Michelangelo statue. Street scene. I think we're going to see the statue. Are we going to see the statue, guys? Speak. Speak, O silent ones. Got a what? Thumbs up from the booth. Shall I go on and come back? I'll go on for a moment. We'll come back. I actually asked Dali quite early on in this, when he first became fully aware of his unique perception of the universe. Affirmation, he told me, had come very quickly one afternoon when, as a child of 10 or 12, he was out for a walk in the woods with his very glamorous and pretty auntie. She, suddenly wishing to urinate, had stood before him, raised her skirts high, revealing a complete lack of underwear, spread her legs wide, and then, whilst he watched, transfixed, she pissed with the force of a cart horse. The amber liquid, he told me, had struck the earth and exploded into myriad rainbows of miraculous, tiny, shining droplets, all of them full of knowledge. And all this suffused in the golden glow of the setting sun. Well, I was intensely jealous, because nothing like this ever happened to me, though I still live in hope. I decided to take the writer Jane Arden with me to interview Salvador Dali. Now, this was a risk. I realized that taking a homegrown, Welsh-born, full-blooded, feminist intellectual like her might well cause ructions at the court of Dali. New York in 1965 was in the grip of one of the bitterest winters on record. I remember that clearly, and I'd taken Suite 212 at the St. Regis Hotel, Dali's winter base. And then outside in the wind-driven snow, I walked down Fifth Avenue. I'd never been to New York before. I had to meet up with my American cinematographer, Jim Desmond. I got to the cafe first and found a table near the window, from which I could watch the world slip and slide by. Yellow taxi cabs appeared and disappeared in dragon clouds of steam vapor billowing up from the gratings of the underworld. And frankly, I'd never been so happy to be anywhere in my life.
He got in the cab and he sort of let you know where he'd gone and then he didn't want to have anything to do with him. You know what I mean? And then when we got out, I said, hey, you didn't pay me. And he kept walking. See? Yeah. And he walked over to the doorman and he said something. Then the doorman came over and said, didn't that, like, even talk to me, you know? That's the type of guy.
The sound, as you can hear, is very, very low, so we've obviously got gremlins in the works up there, but we'll stagger through. Back at the St. Regis Hotel, Salvador Dali, Jane Arden and I had a lovely lunch in the legendary King Cole Room. Then as we were leaving, we walked past a very portly, bald man in a striped suit. He was sitting at a table and in front of him a steaming bowl of spaghetti with clams and mussels had just been set before him by a very elderly and stooped waiter. As I passed the man, he mumbled something at me in the manner of a growl. I stopped dead in my tracks. I retraced my last three steps. And I said to him, are you talking to me? I am, and I said, get your fucking haircut. I don't know what came over me, but quick as a flash, my hands were moving. I grabbed the steaming bowl of spaghetti linguine, I think it's called, and I upturned the lot on top of his head. I inverted the top, the lot. So the spaghetti gave him now long flowing locks of blonde hair, where previously there was no hair. and the clams had taken to slithering down his face, one by one. Dali circled him and then smiled indulgently at me. "Well done, Jacques Bondus," he said. "You have created a magnificent pasta medusa." The man looked up at me through his pasta fringe with hatred in his eyes, and Jane Arden gave me a mild rebuke. "Does it ever occur to you, Jack, that one day somebody's going to pull a gun on you?" Well, years later in New York, somebody did, but that's another story. That night, the 15th of December, four of us piled into a taxi. Salvador Dali, Larry Rivers, Andy Warhol, and myself were all off to the Museum of Modern Art to a retrospective of the work of René Magritte. On the way, Dali told us that he telephoned Magritte that afternoon to see if we could all arrive with pineapples on our heads. Magritte's response was immediate and negative. "If you wish to arrive here, looking utterly ridiculous," he said, "none of you will be allowed in." One true surrealist to another, eh? But when we arrived, Dali introduced me to Magritte, who was standing in front of his painting, Time Transfixed, in the steam train coming out of the fireplace. And in his three-piece suit and gold watch chain, the waistcoat, gold watch chain, he looked, for all the world, like a provincial bank manager. I almost asked him for a loan. Over dinner that night, Dali told me for an upcoming scene we were to shoot with the photographer Philip Halsman, I had to procure 1,000 enormous black ants, alive and well, and at least $500,000 in cash. "Okay, Dali," I said. "Okay, no problem. 1,000 black ants. My God, where was I going to find 1,000 black ants? It was December, New York." We did. Then he pointed his finger to the ceiling and he said, "I need more. I need 12 fresh eggs of a swan." After that scene, I thought he might die of a heart attack at any moment. I was quite scared, actually, for the way he looked. And when I helped him to his feet, the bloody ants ran all over me. And all he could say was, "It's okay, Jacques Bondus, it's okay. Is everything okay?" He inquired it really plaintively. I don't know, I was worried about him. It was only then I discovered that he actually had a lifelong fear of insects. Later that week, we got very lucky with a makeup man. Eddie Sens, who was Elizabeth Taylor's makeup man at the time, joined our crew. It was years later I found out that Eddie, during World War